If you have a Bible, please take it out to the book of Exodus in the Old Testament. The book of Exodus, the second book of the Bible in the Old Testament. The passage in its entirety is printed in the bulletin, all 35 verses, I believe, 36 verses of Exodus chapter 16. And at the risk of putting some of us into a nice, comfortable state, I'd like to read the whole thing. I might stop at, about 30 if I think we should just kind of get back into attention here. But please follow along. It is lengthy. I recognize it is lengthy, but I think it is a whole biblical unit. And so I'm going to read it for us. The entirety of Exodus chapter 16, all 36 verses. Please follow along as I read for us from the English Standard Version Bible. They set out from Elim. And all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in Egypt, in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we that you grumble against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumbling that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord." Verse 9. Then Moses said to Aaron, "Say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling." And as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in a cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God." Well, in the evening, quail came up and covered the camp. And in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the fence of the wilderness, on the face of the wilderness, a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as he can eat. You shall each take an omer according to the number of persons that each of you has in his tent." And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as they could eat. And Moses said to them, "Let no one leave any of it till the morning." But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. On the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay aside to be kept till the morning." So they laid it aside till the morning, as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, "Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none." On the seventh day some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. Now the house of Israel called its name Manna, It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations, so that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt." And Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar and put an omer of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept." The people of Israel ate the manna for 40 years till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. An omer is the tenth part of an ephah. In case you're wondering, this is the word of the Lord. There's a slight, small urban legend that has the sound of an urban legend. And that is to say that every clergy or every church in the city of Boston can get one season or free ticket to Boston Red Sox games for any home game in the standing room only section of Fenway Park. How many of you have heard of this? You heard of this? Okay. This is a kind of an urban thing here, right? That apparently every church in the city of Boston can get one ticket for their pastor, presumably one ticket for like the sole pastor, which is the typical size of a New England church, so that that pastor can go to any home game. I think it's any home game. Pretty sure it's every home game, and have a free seat, have a free place in the standing room only part of Fenway Park. It's actually not an urban legend. It's not a myth. It's totally true. One of my good friends, Pastor Soon Chung Ra, who founded Cambridge Christian Fellowship Church, he's one of the first guys that told me about it. I think Pastor Steve knows about it, but he doesn't cash it in. But if he doesn't, then who are we to do it? And my good friend Eugene, Pastor Eugene Lee of Cornerstone Church, many of you know folks there. They're actually right here now in the South End. Cornerstone Church tells me, yeah, I do it regularly. I get in, and you know what? They even let me carry one of my sons in there. So I'm like standing there with my son watching Sox games in Fenway Park. So I begin the sermon with that because that's the most important point of the message, that a pastor can go to Fenway Park. But behind that is something more significant. Behind that is why. And as I understand it, and as the story goes, it goes something like this. When Major League Baseball was becoming bigger, the pastime of America, when baseball was becoming so popular and lucrative, people realized, why on earth don't we start having games on every single day of the week? Why don't we have games on Sundays? After all, if many of us who are a little older remember, banks were not open on Sundays. You had to go with your parents on Friday afternoon because they had to deposit stuff in the bank. Or maybe early Saturday morning because if they were open Saturday, our banks were open. Well, they were savings and loans back then, but we won't even get into that. But savings and loans were open till like about noon on Saturday. Even in Massachusetts, when I first moved to New England, you couldn't sell liquor on certain days of the week. Certain restaurants couldn't be open. And even parts of the country, mostly in the South, maybe in parts of the Bible Belt, they still have something called blue laws, which were called blue laws because the blue paper that they were printed found by the Puritans, which said, on the Sabbath day, on the day of the Lord, you will not work. And so what does that have to do with pastors in Fenway Park? Well, I guess the Red Sox figured if we can give the pastors free season passes to the Fenway Park Red Sox games, they might just agree. And they did. That's why today, every church or religious sort of church in Boston can have one clergy get one free ticket to any home game in the Sox. I'm pretty sure it's every home game. I don't think it's just Sunday games. You know, times are tough, so they might have changed that. And I've never personally tried it, but I hear it's a good deal. Why do I bring that up that way? I bring it up because we're in a series called Lessons Learned. And the thesis of this series, the premise, the goal of the series really is that we want to learn to make the most of our mistakes. You make mistakes, I make mistakes, and in each of these mistakes, God offers two things. He offers us grace. He offers us hope. He offers us in Christ, forgiveness of sins. He offers us a new start. He offers us relationship. He offers us grace, hope to move ahead. But he also offers us truth, wisdom, a vital and vibrant lesson to be learned so that we don't repeat the same mistakes, so that we can make the most of our mistakes, so that we can, in every one of our mistakes, have a lesson learned. And so if you've been following our series either on the internet or here at our worship services in both campuses, then you'll know that we're here talking about lessons learned. And we've been talking about how to feel bad in a good way, the good way to feel badly. We've talked about a number of other things. And today, we're talking about a lesson many of us have learned or think we have learned. And it usually comes in the form of a phrase, burnout. Burnout is that catch-all phrase whenever you don't feel like doing anything anymore, apparently. Oh, I don't feel like doing homework. I think I'm burnt out. You know, like, oh, I don't feel like going to church. I must be burnt out on ministry. Oh, I don't feel like, you know, exercising. I must be burnt out on the gym. You know, I'm just burnt out. And a lot of people have realized in recent years that the Sabbath principle, the idea of resting, is a great anecdote to burnout. And I'm here to tell you that I don't think this passage is about burnout. And I frankly don't think burnout is about work or rest primarily. So what we're talking about here, keeping the Sabbath, is this idea that on one out of every 7 days, God rested from his work in creation. The children of Israel were commanded by the Lord in Mount Sinai on the Ten Commandments to keep the Sabbath holy. But that was Exodus chapter 20 and forward. This is Exodus chapter 16. This is before the Decalogue, before the Ten Commandments, before the time at Sinai. This is before the quote-unquote Torah, the Old Testament law. This is before the giving. This is grounded in creation itself, that God worked 6 days, and the culmination of that work, the climax of his work, was to stop. And if we talk about lessons learned, this idea of Sabbath, keeping a day of rest, we talk about burnout, I think a lot of people think, oh, that's great. I've burnt out, so what do we learn about this? Well, the first thing we learn about the Sabbath, and this will be the arc of all our 3 points this morning, is that actually the Sabbath is a test. It is a test for you and me, every single one of us. The Sabbath is a test. My preaching professor, a great preacher, someone I really look up to and respect, I still remember his sermon on this passage. And it was very informative and formative for my theology and my preaching. But I realized at this point, I think as I look at this passage, that I'm going to deviate a little bit. He called the Sabbath a gift. That every 6 days, God gives you a day of rest. And boy, what a powerful sermon that is to people in America, right? And I think that's totally true. And I think it's totally legitimate. However, as I looked over this passage and just the word that keep coming out from the text and to us today, is that it's a test. I mean, it's a good test. It's a loving test. But it is a test nonetheless. So our points for this morning, the passage will teach us, I think, 3 things this morning. First of all, what is the test of the Sabbath? What is this test? Okay. Secondly, I believe this passage will teach us how do we actually pass this test? How do we keep the Sabbath and pass that test? And thirdly, what is the goal of passing this test? What is the end product that God is hoping to see in his people? Firstly, what is this test of keeping the Sabbath? Secondly, how do we actually pass this test? And then thirdly, what's the point? What is God's goal? What does God want for us at the end of this? And so here we are in the children of Israel, and I'm going to have to give us some background. It says that they departed from Elim into the wilderness, in the region of Sin, the desert of Sin. And they're departing and they're walking along, and they begin to grumble. They begin to say, man, it's hot out here in the desert. It's just sand, sand, and more sand, okay? And they begin to think back about Egypt. Egypt, which was how many days ago? According to this passage, when you do the math, how many days ago were they enslaved in Egypt? How many days ago did they see God's incredible provision of sending the 10 plagues upon the oppressive Pharaoh, upon the enslavement of Israel? How many days ago, how many months, maybe how many years ago did it happen when God did the Red Sea and he sent the children of Israel across dry land before they come to the place in Exodus 16, verse 2, where it says, the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And verse 3, they were so upset. Have you ever heard this? Maybe from your parents, you ever told your spouse this? Oh, you know, it's better if I'm just not alive, right? Look at this, verse 3. And the people of Israel said to Aaron and Moses, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in Egypt when we sat by not the chains of slavery, not the whips of our slave masters. This is what they remember about Egypt. This is hilarious. When we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. What do you remember about Egypt? Do you remember the whips? Do you remember the lashes of blood on your back? Do you remember the children of Israel being killed by Pharaoh in a genocide and an eradication of all the male children? No, you remember the meat. And you remember the bread. And they have the frustration to have the gall to say that the hand of the Lord would have killed us. And they say this, you have brought us into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. How many days ago was the Red Sea? 30 days ago. 30 days. 1 month before. 1 month before they were enslaved in Egypt. 1 month before they saw the end of the plagues. 1 month before they saw what the Bible calls the angel of the Lord coming through to punish Pharaoh for enslaving the children of Israel, for not letting them go into the wilderness to worship. One month ago, 30 days ago, 30 days ago, one moon cycle-ish almost ago, they saw the Red Sea part and they walked across dry land. They saw the Red Sea close in on the entire Egyptian army and slaughter their oppressive slave masters. 1 month ago, and now they're saying, there's no food here. There's no water here. You brought us out to kill us. Oh, that we could be back in the good old days in Egypt. And if you do a little research in Elim, which is actually the name of one of our fellowships in our church, Elim Fellowship, in Numbers 33, Elim is described as a place with 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees. Which is to say, when they left Elim, you took us from a pretty good place. It was pretty nice there. Now we're just wandering in the wilderness, and you brought us to die. And so the Lord says, I'm going to test you. And how does he test them? He tests them by giving them food. It's kind of a strange test. Kind of a nice test. I'm going to test you. Oh, yeah, how? I'm going to give you what you want. Okay, sounds good to me. And he says, I'm going to give you food. In fact, I'm going to give you, you know, a sort of a, you know, God's diet, okay? I'm going to give you meat at night, you know, so protein builds up your muscles while you're resting. And I'm going to give you carbs in the day, you know, so you can burn it off and stuff. So he's going to give them quail at night and bread or manna in the day. And we see this here. We're going to read just part of it. We're picking it up in verse 6. So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, at evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we that you grumble against us? And Moses said, when the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumbling that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord. And so the Lord says, I'm going to give you quail at night, and I'm going to give you bread in the morning. And what is this test? This test comes in the form of the specific commands about work and non-work. He's going to say this, I want you on the 6 days of the week, the first 6 days, I want you to go, and I want you to go out and collect the bread. And the Bible says that in that first morning there was a dew on the ground, on the face of the wilderness. And, you know, maybe if you've seen dew, it's like this kind of, it's kind of liquidy, it's kind of sparkly, and it's kind of pretty sometimes. And you would think over time it kind of melts. And as the dew kind of melted away, as the mist of the morning faded, they looked on the ground and they said, what is this? In Hebrew, manu, or translated manna. So actually, the word manna means what is this? It's basically, oh, what is this? You want some, what is this? And so they had manna. And I said, what is this? And the Lord said to Moses to tell them, this is the bread. This is the bread from the Lord. And he gave them specific directions. He said this, you know, you got to work for this. You're going to go out and you're going to collect all of the children of Israel. Go out and collect this sort of thin, flaky stuff. And we're going to all put it together and then we're going to distribute it to the camp, to the congregation. And as they distributed it, they found that no matter whatever they gathered, they were able to distribute one omer of worth of food to everybody. An omer is about 4.5 quarts. It's basically, think of it as like a gallon jug of milk. That's about as much bread stuff. It's pretty good. And so they would do that. And the passage says that Moses said, go collect whatever you're going to eat. If you're going to eat a lot, bring a lot. If you're going to eat a little, bring a little. Let's all throw it in. And when they did that, it was exactly one omer per person. And here's where this test happened. He said this, I'm going to give you this bread every day for the first 6 days. So just go out and get it. And you know what? Don't save any of it overnight. Just eat it all. Don't save any of it overnight. Just eat it all. And then, what do you think the children of Israel are saying? That first morning, just imagine. They're hungry, they're grumbling, they look on the ground, there's a stuff, they go, Manu, what is this? What is it? And they eat it, and they cook, they bake it, they can make it taste pretty decent. They're like, this is pretty good. This is pretty good. And then they're reveling now in the food that they have. They've got food from heaven, manna from heaven, literally. And they're excited, and then Moses goes up and says, okay, everyone, eat it all. And they're like, okay, all right. Moses, I know we're all excited, but let's think here. Let's be a little wise and prudent. We don't need to eat it all. We don't need to eat all of it. We can save some. Because, you know, we might need some for tomorrow. And Moses says, no, the point is God says you don't need it for tomorrow because I'm going to provide for you tomorrow. And people go, okay. And wouldn't you know it, some smart Israelites think, okay, they're all going to eat their food. And maybe you're at home in your tent, and the kids said, okay, I want more manna. And mom says, no, we're saving the rest. And they go, but I thought Moses said save it. No, let those fools eat all their food. You'll know why we're saving it tomorrow when there's no more manna, and they're all hungry, and you'll still have food. But the Bible says, when they kept it overnight, something happened. Let's see this here. Let me pick it up here. Coming into verse, it's a big passage. Let's go on down to verse 18. Verse 18 says, when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. Verse 19, and Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it till the morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Now, this is powerful because you couldn't really hide the fact that apparently you had some left over till morning because Moses walking by or you're walking by and you'd smell this putrid, pungent, reeking odor coming from a tent. You go, yep, leftover manna. And they just walked by. So it's really obvious. And it says that Moses was angry with them. For morning by morning, they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. And then the sixth day and seventh day were really special. So they're like, okay, we get it, Moses. Don't take more than that day. Just get your day. And then Moses goes, aha, except for one day. So what happened on the sixth day, they go out, sixth day of the week. They're getting their food. They collect all the food, put it in the thing. They, you know, cook it, bake it, distribute it. And they go, wait a second. There is enough here for two omers for every person. How did that work out? We gather the same amount, and apparently there's two. And so they go, okay, well, I remember the last time we saved too much, so we better go tell Moses. So they go report to Moses. And Moses goes, that's right, there is two, and here's why. Tomorrow is the Sabbath. On that day, you are to not work. Bake what you will today. Boil what you will today. Cook and prepare whatever food you will. But tomorrow, you will not cook or bake food, and tomorrow you will not go out to gather food. For tomorrow there will be no manna outside. And of course, those smart members of the Israelite community go, right. Okay, so you tell us, Moses, you give us this powerful, pungent lesson to not keep more. Yeah, right. Okay. So what they do, you know, some Jews, they realize. Some Jews say, what are you doing? It's the seventh day of the week. And the kid goes, Mommy, what are you doing? Daddy, where are you going? We're going to go out and get manna, like we did every day this week. But Mommy, Daddy, I thought Moses said that don't go out. Says, oh, well, whatever. You know, like, yeah, you know, God helps those who help themselves. One day an American's going to say that, okay? So they're going to go out, and Mom and Dad go out there. And here's Moses. I don't know what Moses is doing in that morning or if he's watching or whatever, but apparently among the camp, there are numbers of Israelites that go out. And, you know, they're like, oh, good morning, not working, just walking a little bit and bending over, nothing there. And, oh, just, you know, not really walking on the Sabbath, but just kind of looking. And apparently, these members of the Jewish kingdom went out looking for manna yet again. And once again, let's see this. In verse 22 says, on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. And when the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, because they're like, we don't want to get busted for this, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil. And all that is left lay aside to be kept till the morning. So they laid it aside till the morning as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you will gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. So the children of Israel, they're probably, okay, where do you want to put the leftover manna? Because we haven't had any left. Oh, put it over there by the side. Okay, not right here in the middle of the place. And they go, check the manna. It looks good. Wow. But, verse 27, on the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? So here is the test. The test is to honor the 1 in 7 principle of setting aside a day to worship and rest in the Lord. That's the simple test. 80 years ago, a disciple of Freud by the name of Sandor Ferenczi, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, who resided in the fairly large city of Budapest at the time, began to diagnose something in his patients he called Sunday neurosis. Sunday neurosis is the idea that on basically Sunday morning, people would get this stomach ache, or they just began to get these cramps and they really couldn't get up and work, except, guess what, his Jewish patients that got that on Saturday. Literally, okay? And he diagnosed something and says, you know, this is things, people just don't want to work on this day of the week. Nowadays, if you go to a therapist, they might diagnose you with something called workaholism and call you a workaholic. The idea here is that we work too much. We overdo it. And here's the test. Will you look at your schedule, look at your life, look at your plans, and honor this principle of 1 in 7 and do no productive work that would earn you money? Will you, in your week, plan it out as a priority that 1 in 7 you will not work the kind of work that you do for a living that would earn your keep, that would earn your money? And the Old Testament had lots of laws. The Jewish scribes had lots of laws. Even the Orthodox Jews, they've got lots of additional laws that somehow in the course of history have gotten a bad reputation for being oppressive laws, torturing the saints. But all these things you can and can't do on the Sabbath. But before we go into that, there's a basic principle on the Sabbath. You say, but that's Old Testament law. We don't need to do it anymore in the New Testament, New Covenant with Jesus. No, this is before the Ten Commandments. This is grounded in creation itself. But we don't do it on the, you know, are you saying we all have to come on Sunday? That's not fair. Well, I actually don't think it's Sunday. And here's why. Because Sunday is the first day of the week. It's not the seventh day of the week. Hence a group of people called Seventh-day Adventists, among others. Mormons are very strict practitioners of the Sabbath. But I believe as Christians in the New Testament, when you take a look at the whole of the Scriptures, and this is a whole like class, and you could spend a lot of time discussing and maybe debating this, and I don't even know if Pastor Steve agrees with me fully, but I think he mostly does, because he always tells me, go home, it's your day off. The idea that 1 in 7, you honor the Sabbath principle. Paul says in Romans and Corinthians, you know, one day, one person thinks that day is holy, another thinks that day is holy, that's fine, to each his own. But the key thing here is this principle. In fact, the Christian church, in the turn of the millennium, 2 millennia ago, were the ones that shifted the day of worship from Saturday to the first day of the week. And there are two reasons biblically, probably some other historical reasons, but two reasons biblically why Christians made the Sunday the focal day of worship as opposed to Saturday?
Well,
probably two reasons biblically, one probably historically. The two biblical reasons are, first of all, the Lord rose on the Sunday. And so the Christians would gather on the first day of the week. And actually, that's why in Revelation, this is the other reason, they call it the Lord's Day. Which is the Lord's Day? Well, every day. No. I mean, well, yeah, that's true. But in Revelation, it says, John writes, on the Lord's Day, I was visited by an angel. Sunday is the Lord's Day. Sunday is the day the Lord Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And probably historically, Sunday also became the day to separate out the Christian practices from the Jewish practices. And so we've already, moved it around. And even then, I believe as a pastor, it's hard for me to really make the case that Sunday is a day off for me. And that Sunday is a day of rest. So my day of rest, as many of you know, is Monday. I try to honor it diligently. I try to keep it for my family as well. And I try not to do emails and send sermon discussion guides. I might email it, but I'm trying to work on those things on Monday. Because there's this principle that we all struggle, I think, especially in America, to keep. But this is the test. In 1 in 7, will you work 6 days? Will you gather for 6 days? And will you on the seventh day rest? Whatever that seventh day is. And again, there's probably lots of smart, godly people that have different views on which day of the week. But that's the principle. Now, some of you are thinking, okay, if this is true, this is probably one question I had, and maybe you had it too. How am I going to do that? How am I going to get all my work done? How am I going to pay the bills? How am I going to feed my family? How am I going to excel in my career if I only work 6 days? If I give up that seventh day, do you know my field? Enoch, do you understand that in my business, I know maybe church is different or whatever, but in my work, man, you don't just, a day off is just unheard of, especially I'm starting out. You just can't do that. Maybe in 20 years when I make partner, maybe. Or some people say, do you understand economically how tough these times are? Are you really telling someone to not work and not go out there and try to put food on their table? Are you really saying that? Those are really great questions. And I think God, in anticipating that very response, gives us the next point. How do we pass the test? How do we rest on the seventh day? How do we trust God for the seventh day? And here's how I pass the test. You pass the test by trusting God on the seventh day by doing this, by realizing He provided on the other 6 days. You realize it is God's provision on the other 6 days. It's not my provision. It's not your provision. It's not solely my hard work. It's not your hard work. It is remembering. Remembering that on the 6 days God provided, so God will provide on the seventh day. And this is what he's saying. The test is basically obeying God's commands. Do you understand the commands? Do you believe it? And we see this here. We already read those really briefly. When we come in here, verse 19, Moses said to them, verse 19, let no one leave any of it till the morning. But they didn't listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. They would not listen. And then going down to verse 26, 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments? This is how you pass a test, to realize this is a command of God. And if God commands you to do it, He will provide and make a way for you to fulfill His command. This is not a humanly devised command. This is not a human imposition. This is God's command. How you pass a test is to realize, I don't know where the money might come from. I don't know how I'm going to make ends meet. I don't know how I'm going to reach my career goals and dreams in this field or in this company or in this school district or in this nonprofit or in this town or in this university setting if I don't really grind it and go to that seventh day. But I know God has commanded me. And if He's commanded me, I just hold up my hand and trust in Him, because not only has He commanded me, He provided for the other 6 days. Because I know what I'm thinking is probably similar to your thinking. Man,
no disrespect to our church, or no disrespect to the office of pastoring, but I think every pastor at some point has thought, not necessarily even at our church, but all pastors at one point go, I wonder how hard it would be to get a second job. I think most pastors have thought, I mean, I can be honest with you, some days I'll go like, Karen, I've even asked this to Karen. I said, well, how do you think the church would respond if they found out I was like working on Monday? She's like, oh, I don't think they'd like that. And they probably wouldn't. And am I being greedy? And I have to tell myself, God will provide. God will provide. And this is how you remind yourself. You remind yourself, this is not about getting the rest so you don't get burnout only. This is not about sort of some cultural imposition or some sort of ancient tradition. This is a divine command of God to trust Him. It is so easy for people to say, the people who care about evangelism and sharing the gospel, you guys don't really obey the command of sharing the gospel. You need to get out there. Stop all your small groups and Sunday school classes just being for Christians. Go share the gospel. Obey the Great Commission. So easy to pick up people. Some people might say, you know, I love social justice, and you guys just don't know. Do you realize how many commands in the Bible are about the poor, about helping the poor, serving the poor, giving to the poor? Come on, obey the commands. And you've got some, maybe one person or no one saying, hello, justice people, evangelism people, worship people, prayer people. What about the Sabbath? It's right there in the top 10. It's right there in the Ten Commandments. Keep the Sabbath. You can't take any pride in obeying commandments at all, especially when we realize that this is probably a command in America so hard to keep. Keep the Sabbath. How will I make ends meet? How will we have enough manna on the last day? Look, the other 5 days, it rots if we keep it over. And God says, no, on the sixth day, I'm going to give you enough. Have you ever wondered why God let Israel be in the desert for 40 years? And many of you know the story, 40 years. You know why? So that by the time they entered the promised land of Canaan, the entire generation that left Egypt had passed on and died off. And everyone in their 20s and 30s and 40s at that point, or I guess, you know, late 30s, whatever, had only grown up in the wilderness. And you know what that means? They only ever knew that we go out and God provides. 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 And we go out and God provides twice as much. And we go out and there's nothing there. He wanted a people that was totally dependent. And you know, honestly, Sabbath keeping will lead to evangelism, will lead to social justice. I mean, one of the great things I was reading about this was that Sabbath keeping was universal. In the Old Testament, God gave animals Sabbath. You won't push your ox down that thing. God gave fields Sabbath. You won't over-harvest that land. God gave slaves Sabbath. Whether you're on high society or low society, God says honor the Sabbath. And actually, some people count it and say, God told you to make sure you give your slaves the Sabbath. God told the people of the Israel nation, even the foreign people in your household, even the slaves, you give them Sabbath. Because that's the test. You pass the test by knowing God doesn't provide on the seventh day because of my abilities. In the same way, He doesn't provide on the first 6 days because of my abilities. God provides. What's the point of this? What is the goal of this? What does God want us to... Why does God care so much about this? And we capture this back here. We're going to zoom back up here. Coming back to chapter 16. And I'm finding it. I'm losing it. Long passage. Really long. Oh yeah, here we go. Verse 6. So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel. And get these phrases. At evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning, you shall see the glory of the Lord, because He has heard your grumbling against the Lord. What He's saying there is this. When you see food coming from the Lord, when you see God's basic provision, you will be reminded of the glory of the Lord, of His hand, that this. What is the point? So that we know that man does not live by bread alone. Man does not live by bread alone. It's a prayer that, Lord willing, I pray with my children every day. And Lord willing, they will pray on their own every day as they leave my house. And Lord willing, they will pray with their children as they grow up, should the Lord give them children. Give us today our daily bread, or some translations say our coming day's bread. You know why? The point of this? The point is to remember, whether we're in Elim with the 12 springs of water and the 70 palm trees, or whether we're in the desert when there's nothing in this forsaken land, that it is God that provides. And that is a test. Every 7 days, a powerful gift and reminder that it is God that sustains me and God that sustains you. So let's get very practical. I understand some of our fields, some of our jobs make it more challenging to do this. I understand that some of our financial situations make it harder to do this. Enoch, are you really saying I can't go out and earn money because otherwise I'm going to go into debt? Doesn't the Bible say don't go into debt? All those sorts of things. It may take the community of God coming together to figure out how to apply this in your specific, maybe particularly challenging situation. And that's why it's a community thing. It takes a community to do the Sabbath. It takes me going to, me being at church on a Monday and someone goes, hey, Enoch, isn't this your day off? And me feeling a little sheepish, maybe even a little embarrassed, I should. It takes me seeing you on another day that you're usually with your family, say, what are you doing here? You shouldn't have your day off. Like, yeah, I know. It takes people saying, isn't today your Sabbath? Isn't today the day of rest? For me, it's Monday. For you, it's Saturday. For you, it's Sunday. For you, it's Wednesday. I don't know what it is. But what changes do you need to make? What do you need to trust in God so that we can learn this lesson? That man does not live by bread alone. And when you trust in Him, you will see the glory of the Lord. You will see the hand of the Lord provide. Judith Shulevit wrote an article in the New York Times several years back. Jewish lady talks about how she went from sort of a non-practicing Jew to basically fully keeping the Sabbath. I don't know if she still keeps the Sabbath day. But she had a great article in the New York Times in 2003 called Bring Back the Sabbath. And I just want to share some words she wrote here. She points out that the story of creation was written in such a way that each day, each new creation is seen as a step toward a completion that occurred on the Sabbath. And what was creation's climactic culmination? The act of stopping. Why should God have considered it so important to stop? Rabbi Elijah Vilna put it this way: God stopped to show us what we create becomes meaningful to us only when we stop creating it and start to think about why we did so. The implication is clear. We could let the world wind us up and set us to marching like mechanical dolls that go and go until they fall over because they don't have a mechanism that allows them to pause. But that would make us less human. And I love the way she ends that article. We have to remember to stop because we have to stop to remember. That's the test. Will you stop to remember the Lord? Will you stop and realize that this is a command as cherished as any command of protecting the weak, serving the poor, shielding the innocent? This command is as important to God as any other command of honor your father and mother, love your children, raise your children in the Lord. This command is as dear as any other command as it is to worship the Lord with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. We have to remember to stop because we have to stop to remember. Let's bow our heads and take this in by the power of the Spirit. Our Father, I definitely feel inadequate telling a fairly highly educated group of folks, highly accomplished groups or people going to schools that will probably put them on a path of great accomplishment in a culture like America, like in New England. And I'm almost scared to preach this as I would be to preach any other command that might be unpopular. And I confess that's my weakness and my sin.
But nonetheless, if we're going to do a series on lessons learned, a series on making the most of the mistakes we've made, a series on the idea that we have to take a look at some of the things that we are repeatedly struggling with, that your word gives us hope and guidance for, then, Lord, I think we would just be remiss if we did not look at keeping the Sabbath, honoring a Sabbath principle. Lord, I know there's students here that honestly are leaving with more questions than answers. What am I going to do? Does that mean I can't study at all on Sunday? There are people here saying, but I'm going to work after service. Should I feel bad? What am I supposed to do? And Lord, there's probably a lot more to be said on this. And I pray that these people would find your answers in your word and would engage in the biblical communities of our small groups, of their Christian friends and spouses and neighbors, and really struggle with this, because this one will probably be something you can't just change in 1 week. But to move our lives in alignment in a way, God, how much of this really is a need issue and how much of this is a desire issue? How much do I just really want certain things that, honestly, maybe if I rest, if I remember to stop, and therefore stop to remember, my priorities might change, or I might see new opportunities that come because I've honored you. Lord, would you give us hope and encouragement that this is something you desire for our good? You give us this one day in seven to focus on you, to rest in you, to spend time with family, to do things that we enjoy. It's not sin, it's not laziness, it's not luxury. According to this, it's divine. It's necessary. It's Christ-like. And Lord, in the same way that we're not called to live from bread alone, we know that Jesus is the bread of life. And maybe that's where it all begins. So for Father, for those of us who aren't Christians here today, I pray that focus is not how to get out of working one day a week, but to realize that the manna, the true manna from heaven, is not the work or the money we earn or the bread we get, but the true manna is Jesus coming down from heaven to be our bread of life. He is what we need. Drive that home to our hearts, we pray.